Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me for the May 11th, 2015 edition of The Heretics Hour, one of the Internet's longest-running radio programs, now well into its fifth year. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your long-running, long-winded host. Tonight, my guest is the author of a new book on Elie Wiesel titled Holocaust High Priest. It's subtitled Elie Wiesel, Night, the Memory Cult, and the Rise of Revisionism. His name is Warren B. Routledge, a new name in the pantheon of revisionists, but he's not new to it. In fact, the part of the book about the rise of revisionism is some very, very good stuff. The book is available at Amazon, at Kodo Bookshop, and at the Barnes Review. Maybe it's available at some other places too, but those are the only ones that I know of. Tonight, we're going to focus on the early years of Wiesel. We're doing the show in two parts. We recorded the first hour and 10 minutes on Wednesday, and on a follow-up day, we recorded the second part, which comes after the music break. This has worked real well and allowed us to fill in a few places where needed. So here we go. So welcome to the Heretics Hour, Warren.
I'm ready for your questions anytime.
Warren, we agreed that, at my suggestion, that we kind of stick with the early part of Wiesel's life on this particular show and go into it in more depth than would be possible if you were going to try to cover everything that's in your book. And I want to say to you, Warren, that I sincerely think your book is a masterpiece. Of course, I have a great interest in Elie Wiesel, so I wanted to know everything that you have to say about him. But you bring in so many other aspects. And I also describe the book as dense. It's a dense read. It's not a real easy read, although if you're trying to read the whole thing in a few days like I've been, that might be the reason, because you don't have to read it all at once. But there's so much in it, and one thing relates to another, and you've done a great job of organizing all that. Would you say it's sort of organized on a chronological basis, as most autobiographies are, but at the same time, it goes off here and there in a way, and then things are picked up later on and brought back in and so on. How would you describe the way that you wrote the book?
Well, I would say the book is organized into three different sections. The first section deals with the introduction and relationship between Elie Wiesel and François Mauriac, the French writer who discovered him, and that relationship led to the publication of the novel. Wiesel calls it an autobiography, but I make it clear through my demolition of this book in my study that it's really a novel. It's not an autobiography. That just about everything in the book is made up. It's the product of someone's imagination. So part one consists of those four chapters having to do with the genesis of Night, the first publication of Night, and then a very important thing is the letters that François Mauriac and Elie Wiesel exchanged, because we have to remember that Wiesel, after he had his book accepted by a publisher in Paris, he went off to New York City, where he claims he was hit by a car in the New York, in the Times Square area in New York City. He claims that for a year his whole body was completely encased in plaster, and that he was able to finish the novel and do all the corrections for his publisher in Paris in that condition. Of course, that's a bunch of rubbish. It was Mauriac who took care of all those details, and I explain all those things, and they corresponded. Wiesel and Mauriac corresponded. They continued to correspond from New York back and forth to Paris until approximately 1964-65, when Mauriac wrote a column in the Figaro newspaper in Paris condemning Israel for its behavior vis-a-vis the Palestinians and called Israel essentially a terrorist state. Well, that's when Wiesel and Mauriac broke off their relationship. They exchanged a few letters after that up until the time that Mauriac died in 1970. But when Mauriac wrote the truth about his feelings about Israel, that was a real body blow to their relationship.
Very good. Now, let's go into François Mauriac more. He plays a very important role, and people need to understand that. Why don't you describe who he was, what kind of a person he was, and what their relationship?
Mauriac was a so-called French Catholic novelist. He was born in the area around Bordeaux. He was one of five children. There were four boys and one girl in the family. And his father died young. He was raised by his mom, who was a very strenuous, old-time, traditional Catholic. And Mauriac went to Paris to study as a boy. And in Paris, he migrated into adulthood and he became a novelist. And by 1933, when he was 48 years old, he was voted into the so-called French Academy, the Académie Française, which is made up of the leading 40 intellectuals in the country at any one particular time. And at that time, the French Academy was definitely right of center. There weren't any Marxists or communists or socialists able to get elected. Mauriac was elected, but once he came into the French Academy in 1933, and events continued to play out in Germany as the World Zionist Congress declared war on Germany in 1933 and initiated a boycott against Germany. The Germans had to respond. Many Jews left Germany, came to the United States, France, other countries. And Mauriac gradually drifted into a man on the right who slowly was migrating over to the left and starting to say things that the communists or socialists would say, expressing his support for the Jews who were leaving Germany and making criticisms of Germany. And Mauriac politically put himself into the anti-fascist camp, which most members of the French Academy were not. They were certainly sympathetic to fascism in Italy and Spain. The important thing about Mauriac is this, is that after the war was over, a French Jewish historian by the name of Leon Poliakov decided to take the Nuremberg documents and write a supposed history of German atrocities during the war. The book is called Harvest of Hate in English, but the title of the book in French is even more provocative. It's called The Breviary of Hate, Le Breviaire de la Haine. And the breviary was the book of daily prayers that priests and other religious had to read every day, 45 minutes to an hour of spiritual reading to make sure that they kept their life focused on the life of Christ as a model. So the fact that Leon Poliakov entitled his book Breviary of Hate in this 1951 book, he was accusing Catholicism of persecution of the Jews, not the Nazis so much, but using this word breviary, a collection of readings, and these readings are just generic atrocity claims made mostly by the Soviets at Nuremberg. But here's the big but: he asked Mauriac to write the introduction to that book, and Mauriac, who had a lot of friends in the Jewish community among Jewish intellectuals in Paris, he agreed to write that introduction. And in that introduction, he accused Pius XII of silence during World War II. So Mauriac is the first major intellectual to accuse Pius XII of silence during World War II. Other Jews in the communist and socialist marginal people who wrote for Humanité or Humanity, which was the daily newspaper of the French Communist Party, made comments like this or that Pius XII had been silent. But that was part of being a communist at that time. The communists and Pius XII were at odds. And so the communists called him all kinds of names at that time during the Cold War after 1945. So here's Mauriac, and he's saying that, there were so many Paris priests who did this and that, but it sure would have been nice for the successor to St. Peter to have spoken out and to have done more to condemn the treatment that the Jews were undergoing. And at this point, I open up a parenthesis and I say that historians have forgotten something very, very important. Pope Pius XII did not make any accusations, first of all, about an extermination program going on, because he never believed that there was an extermination program. I'll talk about that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back and you look at other examples of silence, they're absolutely amazing. There was a series of propaganda movies made in the United States, Why We Fight. And those films were shown in movie theaters and brainwashed people. But they never mentioned that the Jews were undergoing any special persecution. Why? Because people, ordinary people at the grassroots, I know in my family when I grew up, and people in my social circle, they said, this war is a war we're fighting for the Jews. People felt very strongly. Americans were very, very strongly opposed to this war at the grassroots level. Of course, the media were just as strongly controlled by Jewish interests then as they are now. But without the internet, they were able to keep it quite secret. But at the grassroots, many people felt that. When the first dead bodies were discovered in one of the out camps just outside Buchenwald, or Dov, or whatever it's called, General Eisenhower saw some bodies that the Germans had put on a pyre in order to burn these bodies, which were dead and which were rotting from typhus. As a hygienic measure, they burned these bodies. And Eisenhower saw that, and he said, gee, now our soldiers are always saying, we don't know why we're fighting. We don't know why we're fighting. And now look, we can look at this pyre, and now we can see why we're fighting. Mm-hmm. That was verbal shorthand by Eisenhower. What he was basically saying is, the average infantryman in the U.S. Army was a kid 18 years old who was drafted. He was campaigning, going through Germany, killing everything, destroying everything in his wake. The average GI, 18 years old, who was drafted, about 80% of them had never even been out of the county mm-hmm. in which they were born. And they were wondering why the hell they were fighting and why they were destroying one beautiful town after another. One beautiful church after another. They had never seen so many beautiful places, but they were destroying everything that they marched through. And so when Eisenhower said that, he was making an allusion to the fact that on the ground, people felt that this was a war for the Jews. They didn't know why they were fighting. And so Eisenhower wanted to refer to that. I also have another quote in my book as an example of this silence. The Senator Dodd, who retired several years ago in the state of Connecticut, his dad, Tom Dodd, was a member of the prosecution team at Nuremberg. And I quote a letter that he wrote to his wife while the prosecution was going on. And he says in that letter that 75% of the members of the prosecution team, the United States prosecution team of the Germans, were American Jews. He said, this is absolutely outrageous. The Jews shouldn't be here, but it's so obvious that this is a racial persecution that's going on here, because 75% of the prosecutors on the staff are Jewish. Only the figureheads, like himself and his boss, were not Jewish. And he said, I know that people are still saying this was a war for the Jews. And the fact that 75% of the prosecutors here are Jewish is just going to continue to have people keep on saying that World War II was a war for the Jews. So there was a lot of silence that went on, certainly in the media. Well, Moriak, in this introduction to Polyakov's book, when he says Pius XII should have spoken out, Moriak was being hypocritical when he said that. Why? Because during the war in 1943, Moriak, courageous man as he was, he stayed in his own home in the area outside the city of Bordeaux in the southwest of France. His family had extensive land holdings wine vineyards, and in fact the demarcation line between the German-occupied area and the so-called free Vichy area ran right through his property. He had to put up a German captain and his orderly in his home. They got the best room in the house. He had to pay their room and board under the armistice that had been signed at the end of hostilities in June 1940. But Mauriac wrote a book which he signed with the pseudonym of Forez, and the book was called The Black Notebook, Le Cahier Noir. It's called The Black Notebook. He published it clandestinely in 1943. It was immediately translated into English, and it became a propaganda vehicle in England and the United States. So what he wanted to do, essentially in that book, was to continue to argue on behalf of the Jews by keeping a silence that was quite similar to Pius XII's and never mention the word Jew. So how did he go about doing this, keeping the same silence that Pius XII was observing during the war? He told a story about his son and his wife, his oldest boy, Claude, and his wife, Jeanne. They were at a station in Paris one day, and they saw some Jewish boys and girls being put on a train to go to the suburbs. It wasn't a cattle car or anything, it was just a regular passenger train, and they were leaving, going who knows where. They might have been going to one of the transit points, they might have been orphans, who knows where they were, but they saw these kids getting on the train. So he said, I saw these children getting on the train. It was a cattle car. There were no cattle cars. That's a lie he made up. So here he is giving, Mauriac is the first false witness to the Holocaust already in 1943. And he says, I saw these children on the train, and who knows whatever happened to them once the train pulled out. He failed to mention the fact that these kids are Jews, but he didn't have to. Because most people realized just the fact that he was telling the story, obviously, people were so brainwashed in the United States and Britain, they figured they were able to interpret and just write in the word Jewish. And so Mauriac observed the same silence in his propaganda pamphlet, The Black Notebook, that Pius XII did, and not specifically condemning an extermination, but of course in his case, he knew there was no extermination going on.
Now, you do think that Mauriac was a brilliant man and a great writer, but you're faulting him, and he's a Catholic too.
Yes.
But you're faulting him for what? Why do you think he became such a Judaophile?
Why did he become such a Judaophile? I think the reason for that is that his mother had been such an... During the Dreyfus Affair, when he was a young man, he was born in 1885, he was a teenager. His mother read the right-wing papers, and she was totally convinced of Captain Dreyfus's guilt that he was a Jew and a German spy. And his mom and all of his brothers, his three brothers and his mother, were violently, had strenuous feelings against the Jews as being a foreign element in the body politic of France. And as he got older and became a world figure, he might have felt that he was making reparation of some kind for the feelings that existed in his family. His mother was long gone, but his three brothers were all strong supporters of fascism in France, and one of those brothers was a priest. So he might have felt that he was doing penance by helping Elie Wiesel in his literary career and switching over and becoming a Judaophile.
So then, when did he meet Elie Wiesel, and how did that go?
He met Elie Wiesel in May of 1955 at a cocktail party at the Israeli embassy in Paris. And Elie Wiesel came up to him, introduced himself, and asked for if he could interview him for the newspaper he worked for, a Yiddish newspaper he worked for. And Mauriac said, fine, why don't you come over to my apartment sometime? And Wiesel later said, I was just amazed at how nice he was to me, but I try to explain in the background that Mauriac led a hidden life. He was a closet homosexual, and he had a number of affairs with young men. And he had a reputation of being a guy who collected young men and who was easily, and who was flattered by the company of young men. And I surmise in my book, of course, I don't say that Liesel and Lauriac had a physical love affair. There's no proof that that happened. But I think it's pretty clear that Lauriac, with his interest in young men, was very much interested in Liesel, thought he was attractive. And one of the reasons why Liesel went and consulted Lauriac and said he wanted to interview him was because it was already known among the Jewish people, that Jewish intellectuals that Liesel frequented in Paris, that Lauriac was the kind of guy who was always willing to invite a young man over to his apartment. Mm-hmm. Well, what Liesel wanted, Liesel has said that he wanted to get Lauriac to introduce him to another French politician. That's a total lie. What reason he gave for talking to Lauriac was that he had a manuscript and he wanted to ask Lauriac to help him with his manuscript. But he invented this pretext later on when he gave it his version of the first meeting between the two of them. He said that he wanted to get Lauriac, whom he didn't know, to introduce him to another French politician, whom Wiesel didn't know either, a Jewish politician.
Right. You know, I believed that part of it. I fell for that. I mean, I didn't think, well, that was just a pretext. So it's interesting to me that you're saying that that was never really a part of it, just another one of Wiesel's stories that he adds to what actually happened. So that's interesting.
Yes. So the big question is, one question is, when Liesel made this appointment, and in May 1955, went over to Mauriac's appointment, did he tell Mauriac he had a French manuscript, or did he tell him he had a Yiddish manuscript? Because at the same time in May 1955, he had the manuscript for this book called On the World Has Forgotten, written in Yiddish, was accepted for publication in Buenos Aires. And it appeared later in November 1955. So there was a Yiddish book. I don't think, Liesel might have told him that he had a Yiddish book. And Lauriac, and later what Liesel did, he claims that he built, or he translated the so-called, what I call a bridge text. That's to say, he gave a loose translation of a very much shortened version of the original Yiddish book and gave that to Lauriac to give Lauriac an idea of what his book was all about. And he asked Lauriac to take that bridge text and shop it around, in particular with his own publisher, an avant-garde publisher in Paris, the editions of Midnight, their publishers, and Lauriac did just that. And he got his publisher, who had published the Black Notebook during the war in 1943, he got this publisher to publish Liesel's book. But then...
Mm-hmm. But let's go back, before you go any further with that, let's go back to the Yiddish book. You know, my understanding of that is that when his first meeting with Lauriac, and Lauriac told him he should write a book about his experiences, and he didn't tell him that he was already working on a book, but he tells the reader of his autobiography that he was already working on or thinking about this book, or he couldn't have been because he has this 10-year vow, his vow to not write anything for 10 years, and the 10 years wasn't up. But at the same time, this Yiddish book existed. What is your, this is one of the most mysterious parts of the Elie Wiesel story. Go ahead.
I've seen and held in my hands a copy of the Yiddish book, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't read Yiddish. It's written in Hebrew script. It's basically a corrupted version of the German language. It's a German dialect, but written in Jewish characters. So, but I once held a copy of the book. I'd say it's about twice the length of the final version of Night or La Nuit. It's about twice the length of
That's the revised one. But the original one was not published, though, so you wouldn't have held that one. The original one was twice as long as that, if not four times as long as that. So it was supposedly the original Yiddish book was 500 or 600 pages, but if those were typewriter pages, that could vary quite a bit.
I think there's some exaggeration there. Wiesel's biographer, Jack Kolberg, published a book in 2000, The Life of Elie Wiesel, and he was given to exaggeration and inexactitude. He wanted to present Wiesel as a European intellectual, which he was not. He was just a dim-witted guy who could only do one thing in life, and that's just sit around and read the Talmud and make commentaries on the Talmud, parsing words and speculating upon what words meant. And so I think Jack Kolberg, he might have been told by Wiesel that my original book was 702 pages, and I boiled it down to 156. And Jack Kolberg either repeated that or invented it himself. He's always trying to make Wiesel sound like a fantastic European intellectual. But in my view, the copy of the book I saw, I would say, is not four times longer than Knight.
No, it was 200 and some pages, is what I understand.
So it would be maybe 300 pages as opposed to the finished product of Knight being 150 pages, depending upon the pagination, 350 as opposed to 175.
Right.
It's about twice as long. Mm-hmm. And as you know, in my book, I emit the call. I'm hoping that somebody will someday provide us with a responsible translation into French and into English of that Yiddish version of the book with the side-by-side version of Knight so we can compare the two texts.
You know, I have on my Elie Wiesel Cons the World website at the time that the person who calls himself Kladderadatch, who's very good translator and could translate from Yiddish, and he volunteered to me in a private message and emails that he would help me with this, and he translated quite a lot of passages, certainly not the whole book, but the passages that I felt were most...
Carolyn, that would be one of the most fantastic things that anybody could possibly do, so that we can make important comparisons on key
Well, sure, and I have some of those posted, and I have more of them even in my files. But what he found was that a lot of things related to Elie Wiesel's family, but C. Wiesel could have added those names and his sister's names and so on to whatever book, because let's just get into this right now a little bit. You have said now...
Let me just say one thing about what you just said there. Uh-huh. This individual, you know, would be performing a wonderful service.
Well,
because we can look at all the important key passages in the novel and compare.
Well, sure.
Compare the two.
Sure, he was doing that, but then somehow I ran out of things. I had everything I needed, so he didn't do any more. But later, Carlo Mattonio realized I had those Yiddish passages, and he wrote and asked me if I could put him in touch with someone who could do that, and I put him and this Kladderadatch together. And I think that's what he used, why he has that in the essay that he's written on Elie Wiesel, which is extremely important, I think, and is added at the end of your book.
Well, the very fact that the Holocaustians, the people who are the Holocaust profiteers, who use the Holocaust story to justify the existence of Israel and their crimes that the Israeli Jews commit against the Palestinian people, the people who manage the day-to-day operations of the Jewish Holocaust narrative, the fact that these people who use Elie Wiesel as a figurehead for their movement and constantly tell us what a great intellectual he is, the fact that they have never translated the original work, I think tells us an awful lot. That we need to know that there are lots of things in there that they're hiding. They're hiding something. Otherwise, that thing would have been translated a long time ago. And that's an additional reason for us to want to get you to maybe light a fire under this friend to get as many passages as we possibly can translated into contemporary English.
Right. And he translates into French too. So he compared. We were comparing the Yiddish and the French, and then the English version together. And I have quite a number of those passages. But there are some of them on the article. When did Elie Wiesel arrive at Auschwitz? Could he have received the number A77113? He worked with me on this article, and this is probably the main article that I wrote about. Whether Elie Wiesel could have been at Auschwitz or not, but I have a lot of articles about whether Elie Wiesel was at Buchenwald. In fact, I've got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I counted this morning, so I work more on the Buchenwald, and that's easier to show because there's not much information about Auschwitz and him, right? Do you think? I mean. But we'll get into that later, and maybe not too much later. But this Yiddish book, I had that question right away, Warren, whether, as I started reading about things, I thought, when he writes about how he wrote the book, of course, he doesn't tell the truth about any of it. So you just put it down, I think, to that, well, he's just making up stories. But I thought, well, this shows that he didn't write this book. But then I gave that up because this Sloterdijk did seemed to think that that was not a very good position to take, because so much in the Yiddish book he showed related to what was in Wiesel's book Night. But you have suggested that he maybe created that book out of a lot of other people's stories, and if that's the case, he could have just made it, put his own family's names in there and so on. Yeah.
There's one thing we haven't discussed with regard to that first meeting that took place at the Israeli embassy in Paris in 1955. And I'd just like to bring up that one point for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
There were two versions of this meeting. And François Mauriac died in 1970 at the age of 85.
Mm-hmm.
7 years after he died, Wiesel wrote a book in Paris called A Jew Today, Un Juif Aujourd'hui, A Jew Today. And in that book, A Jew, it was just a collection of short essays. And in that, he described meeting Mauriac for the first time. And prevaricator that he is, he says that that first meeting took place in 1954 and not 1955. And the reason he said that is so that he knew in 1977 when he wrote this that Mauriac had been dead for 7 years. He knew that Mauriac had been dead for 7 years, so he wasn't going to go around and correct him on this point. But what Wiesel wanted to do by moving the original meeting back a year was then to give himself more time for having met Mauriac in May 1954 and then having his book finally ready by the end of 1950, finally having written the book, because he claimed in this essay in 1977 that he had written nothing, that he was still under his so-called 10-year vow of silence. And when he met Mauriac in 1954, Mauriac said to him, "You must write this book. You must write this book." As Mauriac was sitting there on the sofa in tears, after Wiesel had told him all kinds of tall tales about the atrocities he had allegedly seen in Auschwitz, and Mauriac said, "You have to write. You have to write that book." So brazen liar that Wiesel is, he told his readers and the world in 1977, that they had met in 1954. That would give him 18 months to start his novel from scratch and then have it ready to show to Mauriac at the end of 1955, and then for Mauriac to start to work with it and so forth. For the novel to be ready for publication in Buenos Aires in 1955. At that time, the world didn't know that the book even existed in 1977. People didn't even know that the Yiddish version of the book actually existed at all. We only found out about that about another 10 late years.
What was it that brought that out? Because he wasn't going to tell anybody.
Exactly. He's a snake, this man. He's so underhanded. He lies about everything. But what Wiesel didn't realize when he said that in 1977 is that Mauriac, in one of his columns, he had a column he published every week in the Figaro newspaper called Notepad, my notepad, or my le bloc-note, my notebook. And in it, one day, 1955, he talked about some students who had come to visit him. He said, I had a Japanese student come and visit me, a young Australian come, and a young Israeli come to visit me recently. And, of course, that young Israeli was Weasel, and that happened in May 55, not 54. Well, that newspaper article was published and forgotten. Nobody paid any attention. But in the middle 90s, an eminent Mauriac scholar at the Sorbonne went back and took all of Mauriac's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of weekly newspaper columns and published them in a five-volume book. And once they were published in the five-volume book, it became apparent. He put a footnote in there and he said, this has got to be Weasel. Weasel always claimed that the meeting took place in 1954, but it was actually 1955. He didn't know it was 1954. He didn't know Weasel that well. But once I saw that Mauriac said 55, I obviously was able to identify Weasel as the person that he was talking about and prove the fact that Weasel had been lying again when he said he met Mauriac in 54.
Well, you know, what I noticed is that in his, I had to make a lot of use of his autobiography, All Rivers. What is that, rest of that? All Rivers Flow to the Sea. Because I didn't have access to a lot of other things and things in foreign languages and so on. So I scanned that real carefully. And you know, he said so many things in that autobiography that in a blatant way contradicted what he wrote in Night or what he said elsewhere. Like, and one of them was these dates for when he wrote the, when he met Mauriac, when he wrote the book, when he went to Brazil and so on. So, you know, all of that, it's kind of amazing that he would have, and he wrote the, his autobiography in the 90s. Probably, it was published then. And, it's amazing that he would make all those errors, or was it on purpose? Why, do you have any explanation for that as to why he would say different things, in that autobiography of his?
It's truly amazing. I believe, let's take an example of, I don't know if you're thinking of something like this, but in the novel, Night, he says that in January 1945, just before the Soviets arrive, he had a case of frostbite on his foot. He went to the Jewish doctors in the SS hospital in Monowitz, and he was operated on for his frostbite. Yet, in All Rivers Run to the Sea, he claims that at that time he had a problem with his knee, and the Jewish doctors at the SS hospital operated on his knee. Now, this is absolutely astounding that he can make a mistake like this. After all, Night is supposed to be an autobiography in which everything allegedly happened. If he had actually had an operation for frostbite, there was every reason to believe there might have been a scar left on his foot or scar tissue of some kind. How could he then write later on in his autobiography that it was a knee operation? How could his editors have let that go through? Everything is so sloppy. Everything is so sloppy. And that is one of the things that leads me to believe that Weasel never really wrote that book in the first place, that he might have found short stories or a book of reminiscences or texts of some kind that existed in Yiddish that he and maybe some other people had put together. And when that book was originally published in Yiddish in Buenos Aires, that perhaps it was a slapdash work that he didn't have much to do with, but he just wanted to become an author, to be somebody. There's another proof of that he doesn't write the book, and that is, to go on to a slightly different subject. Weasel has a certain amount of, what the French call pudeur, P-U-D-E-U-R. It's a certain reserve about things having to do with bodily functions, and he's different from a lot of the so-called survivors who like to talk about bodily functions and bodily fluids and so forth. They're obsessed by it. And there's a scene in the cattle car when Weasel and his family first leave Auschwitz, first leave Szeged, and they're going to Auschwitz. And he talks about the Orthodox boys in the train sodomizing each other, and the moms and dads and the little brothers and sisters are sitting there quietly while these boys engage in anal sex with each other. When the first time I read that, I was so shocked. I was shocked. I'm an old-fashioned person. I was shocked. How could this be in the book? How could these people do this? And it doesn't seem to me to be in line with Wiesel's personality.
Let me just make clear to the listeners that this is in the Yiddish book that you're talking about. I mean, it does carry over to the other, but it starts out in the Yiddish book.
The French book.
Well, it carries over to the French book. Yes, but it starts out, it's in the Yiddish book.
It's in the French book.
Yeah, it is. Right.
Yeah. So, he was raised as a Hasidic Jew. Why would he say these things about the people who belong to his community that he grew up with? That's the kind of thing that Jews who are not religious, secularized Jewish people who very often despise Orthodox Jews, have very, very strong feelings of hatred and dislike for Orthodox Jews and look down upon them as nutcases. When I read that passage, I feel that Wiesel, being such a strenuously and pious Orthodox Jew, he could not have written this, but then at the same time, why didn't he pick up on it? Why didn't he delete it? Why didn't other editors who read it delete this? That's the thing I can't figure out. And that remained in the text until about 2002, when rabbis in France complained so much about this scene that the original publisher, Midnight Editions, Édition de Minuit in Paris, changed it to the young people were embracing each other or caressing each other. They tried to water it down a little bit. So this window opened onto the inner life inside Orthodox Jewish communities and families, so that window could be closed and non-Jews couldn't look through it anymore.
Wasn't it, I thought it was Wiesel's wife who made that change.
Oh no.
In her new translation. No.
She translated the change. That change was originally made by the rabbis in 2002.
Okay.
So that every subsequent edition of the book that is published in France since 2002 has changed the verb from copulating with each other to caressing each other. And then when Marianne came along and saw that in 2007, she translated that into English the same way.
Because, you know, this is in the English book, too, and has been all along. But I thought, you know, I have another question. He uses the phrase young people, and you seem to think it was boys, not boys and girls.
Young people is very, very vague. Mm-hmm. Young people is very, very vague. And again, doesn't necessarily mean boys and girls, especially in the context of Orthodox Jews, where boys and girls are totally segregated. They never even look at each other. And a teenage boy of 14 or 15 wouldn't know what in the world to do with a girl. They hardly ever see them, much less ever talk to them, unless they're with maybe a sister in their family. So we cannot eliminate at all the possibility that this was homosexual activity. And in fact, it's more than likely, given this social segregation that existed and exists to this day in radically, strongly Orthodox milieus, social spheres.
Could it be that they put on the story that they really don't enforce that in actuality? Because I think, you know, Jewish people seem to be pretty free sexually. But I think what your position is interesting. I just hadn't thought about that myself. So if it's that, that brings us back to the subject of homosexuality, which I wanted to go into just a little bit more. The fact that Mauriac was a mature figure, a mentor type person to Elie Wiesel, and then he's had other older men in his life. And it brings you to the question, I think you have a suspicion that Elie himself is homosexual tendencies, but you don't want to say it because there's no proof, I understand.
All I can say is that you grow up as a Hasid, there is strict segregation between boys and girls. And he says himself in his novel, as a boy, he would go and sit in the synagogue at night, and instead of being home with his mom and dad and his three sisters, he would sit in the synagogue at night, and Moshe, the sexton, or the guy who was charged with taking care of the synagogue, putting out the candles and sweeping up and tidying up in the pews and so forth and getting ready for services. This man sat and watched them night after night, and then one day he approached them, and they used to sit together until 10 o'clock at night every night in the synagogue, sitting there and weeping about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Well, this is unusual for a boy, a teenager, to be involved with this oddball, like a village idiot type, who works around the synagogue part-time. Then later on, he talks about how in 1943, his family couldn't go on their usual fancy vacation. They usually went to a resort of some kind on vacation, but by 1943, the security situation, wherever they went in Romania, it didn't work. So his family didn't go on vacation, so he spent all that time in the summer with three friends of his, and they went into mystical ecstasies together. And there might have been five boys altogether. Three of them had a nervous breakdown and couldn't talk. They lost the ability to speak. But the leader of the group, he managed to stay in good shape, and he and Weasel met together during those weeks when Weasel didn't go on vacation because of the security situation. And Weasel and this other young man, he said they went through all these mystical experiences. But, you know, this is a way, I believe, of talking about something else. And then, of course, once he got to France, he was approached on a commuter train coming out from Paris, going out to the orphanage where he lived, and he was picked up by another man, Shushani, Mordecai Shushani. And he was totally dominated and psychologically abused by this man for two or three years. And I say psychologically abused. And Weasel describes the psychological abuse quite concretely in his autobiographical writing. So there's a pattern here of relationships with older men that does indeed raise questions. It raises questions. But
and what about Francois Wahl? If that's how you pronounce that last name, W-A-H-L. His homosexual friend in Paris while he was still in the orphanage? I believe.
Yes, then was the boy, Francois Val, W-A-H-L, who gave him tutoring, who gave him lessons at his home when his mother was away at work. And, Francois Val later became a very, very well-known philosopher. He was approximately Weasel's age, maybe 3 or 4 years older. Maybe a little bit more, maybe born about 1920. Weasel was born in 1928. And, once he became well known, Francois Val was completely out of the closet and said that he became a out of the closet homosexual when he was 15. So everybody knew when he was still in high school. He never hid it. Well, this is amazing that Weasel would have this friendly, deep friendly relationship with this boy, going to his home every day, taking French lessons. And I think that's one of the reasons why his biographer, Jack Colbert, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, changes the name of François Val to Gustave Val, perhaps in order to hide the fact that the Val, W-H-A-L, that Morick was so closely associated with, was in fact this young man who had declared his homosexuality as a teenager. It's all very troubling. It's all hidden. It's all hidden. Mauriac had all these rumors about him throughout his whole career. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole dimension about Weasel's life that we really don't know anything about that's being hidden by the powers that be. And when it comes out, it'll really be quite powerful. It won't surprise me if it turns out to be what I suspected, but I want to make this clear. I'm not saying that Weasel was a homosexual. I'm saying that there are troubling descriptions that he gives of intimate relationships and long-term relationships with older men, where he seems to play a submissive role to these older men. And I'm inquiring about what the nature of those relationships happen to be. In the case of Mauriac, the fires had gone out by the time he met Weasel, but he could still be attracted to young men, and that was his favorite relationship with the love affairs that he had, was men who were 30 or 40 years younger, 25 years younger than he was, and he cheated for years on his wife and broke her heart. I'm told that there is still a correspondence that has not been published by anyone. It's been seen only by one person, who's a professor, a Marriott specialist in Great Britain, who tells me that he's seen some of these letters. But this is a correspondence between Mauriac and his wife in which they talk about his dalliances with men. And as I say, that's under lock and key. It's under lock and key, and who knows when it will ever be published, if ever.
Right. Well, okay. How about now, how all the reasons to believe that Mauriac was more responsible for the final product of Night than Elie Wiesel?
Yes, so in the book, I go over to the website for the publisher who published that book in 1958. And of course they talk about how difficult it was to publish the book because Wiesel supposedly had his whole body encased in plaster in a hospital in New York City. Oh, how could he write? How could he get instructions on the manuscript? Well, on the website, they talk about getting ready to publish the book and they were planning to bring it out at Wiesel wanted to publish it on the anniversary of the liberation of Buchenwald, but at the last minute when they were getting ready to publish the book, the only copy, the copy that they were working on, was in Mauriac's possession, and he did take it with him on vacation for a month or 6 weeks. Well, if Mauriac had nothing to do, Mauriac had nothing to do with preparing the final version of Night for publication, what in the world was he doing with the one super copy that everybody was working on, and why did he take it with him on vacation if he wasn't doing one final go-through to make sure that that book was ready to finally be published? Mm-hmm. I take this as proof that Mauriac had a very, very active hand in the redaction of the final version of that book. Whereas, the publisher tries to give the impression that the head editor in Paris and Wiesel handled all the changes. But first of all, that would have been impossible corresponding back and forth, especially with the supposed author, Wiesel, being in plaster. And the only reason he was, well, I won't get onto that subject yet, just yet, but Mauriac is the one who had the final say. And I want to show, if you look at the final scene of the book in The Face in the Mirror, and you compare the scene of The Face in the Mirror in the Yiddish version, mm-hmm. with the face in the mirror in the final version in French, clearly Mauriac, completely rewrote that whole scene.
Oh yeah, yeah. Although, you know, when I read it, I liked the one in the Yiddish best because it gave a lot of information, that you could, kind of tear apart and look into and so on. So I like what's in the Yiddish better than the cleaned up version as far as doing, learning about Elie Wiesel.
And if, just for your listeners, let me say that in the Yiddish version, when you get to the end of the novel, the author, he's in the men's room, the bathroom, he's looking in the mirror, and he goes into a long diatribe, he's looking in the mirror, he goes into a long diatribe, and saying, here we are, it's more than 10, it's almost 15 years after the war, and the Germans are walking down the street. They're not feeling any guilt. Their country's being rebuilt under the Marshall Plan and so forth. They don't feel guilty. All the so-called German war criminals have gone free. The world has forgotten all the sufferings of the Jewish people during the war. And then he takes his fist and he breaks the mirror. He also wanders off on a few other subjects. Well, Mauriac got rid of all the diatribe about the Germans and this and that, and Mauriac just has him go in and look at the face in the mirror. He sees himself in the mirror, and Mauriac uses that image as a symbol for Jewish suffering that took place during the whole war. And so the young man looks in the mirror, and he sees a cadaver looking back at him. So Mauriac eliminated maybe 500 words of baloney and bluster and fourth-class sophomoric writing, which is typical of Wiesel, and he, master that he was, reduced it to 100 words or so with a powerful image, which gave the book tremendous power. That Wiesel with his pretty dim mental lights and his intellectual limits, could never have done.
All right. Well, that's a very good point. But, you know, the Yiddish version tells us more about Wiesel than the cleaned-up Moriak version does. And that's why I'm interested in it. In every aspect, it pretty much follows along the same subject matter, the same events and so on, but it writes a whole lot more about them than the edited
yes,
one.
That's true.
And, of course, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to edit things down. But I don't know. I guess I can't feel as certain as I one time did that Wiesel didn't write that book. He could have been writing it. As you said to me at one somewhere, or you wrote it, that he had been working on it. I think it might be in your book somewhere, that he had been working on it since he actually got out of the camps in one way or another. And then elsewhere you say, well, he just started working on it after, at some point. Now, the ending of the book, the Yiddish book, says that he started working on it right away after he broke the mirror and started feeling better, and he started working on writing about it.
Well, I guess, Carolyn, I would say I don't have any definitive answer because there are so many arrows pointing in different directions. Wiesel, first of all, says you wrote the book. Well, you have to take that statement seriously. He says you wrote the book. Okay, fine. And he presented a bridge text of that book at some point to Moriak, and Moriak took that to his publisher. But at the same time, we have the passages that we're talking about here. He talks in the book about having gotten frostbite on his foot. Yet in his autobiography, he talks about having injured his knee in an industrial accident. So how could he have forgotten? How could he have forgotten that he got frostbite?
Yeah.
Unless perhaps that arrow is pointing to the possibility that he just plagiarized that text. He stole it from somebody else, and over time he forgot that he had stolen that particular
story. But you know, like you said, his editors, I mean, I don't see how he could forget and publish that, go all the way through the publishing process or pre-publishing process, and it not be brought up to him. Wasn't he married at that time? What about his wife? He said his wife was always helping him and, you know, editing everything and so on. How could anybody miss that? You know, when I came across that, I was like, wow, Eureka, you know, and I wrote something about it. But like everything you write about this man that is astounding, people who are interested in revisionism find it interesting or care about it, but the rest of the world just doesn't want to pay a bit of attention to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, whether he wrote the whole book or not is a topic which will be discussed for many years to come. But the fact is, the book that was finally produced in Yiddish and the book finally produced in French that exists and that poor, unfortunate American youngsters in high school have to read in their brainwashing classes in school, that book shows that the narrator in that book, and we're presuming that Elie Wiesel claims to be the narrator of that supposed autobiography. He didn't know diddly about the physical layout at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. He knew nothing about the place. He didn't know anything about what Dr. Mengele looked like. He knew nothing about the travel realities of getting on a train and traveling from Buchenwald to from Auschwitz to Buchenwald and so forth. He knew nothing about the fact that he would have had to get a new ID when he got off the train in Buchenwald. He would have had to show his old ID and get a new ID, or have to write his new ID onto the old ID, and so forth. He knew nothing about all the administrative procedures that were going on. And, of course, as far as the liberation of Buchenwald goes, you've done so much work on that subject with all the contradictions that are involved there. I've done work on it. And the blogger Further Glory, he continues to work on it. He's just a liar. He just made up everything. So it's pretty clear that the narrator was not where he claims to have been and just made up the story.
Well, that brings us to what Carlo Mantegna has said, which I'd like to bring up, because that he also backs up. I mean, I wrote, well, where did I? I've got it somewhere, but I wrote a long time ago already, that I didn't believe Elie Wiesel was at either camp, but I certainly knew he wasn't at Buchenwald. And I have quite a number of articles, this, that, and the other approach to it, that he definitely was not there, but it's a little bit harder to decide about Auschwitz. But if he wasn't at Buchenwald, he wasn't at Auschwitz either, really, because he went from there to Buchenwald from Auschwitz based on that character that was there. And now Carlo Mattonio has come out. I didn't see these strong statements that are in this essay now that's at the back of your book. So I just want to quote a couple of them. On page 404 in your book, he makes a statement, "It is therefore irrefutably ascertained that Elie Wiesel is a liar and a perjurer about Auschwitz." And then he says, on page 412, "It is obvious that we have here nothing but a simple subterfuge used by Wiesel to style himself as an eyewitness of a horrific but purely fictitious event." And then he talks about how Wiesel discusses what happened after he arrived, and then he goes through it by a person who was there, Ted Hughes Iwasco, and what he says about it, totally, totally different from the way Wiesel describes it. And now he finally says, "In short, Elie Wiesel was never interned either at Birkenau or at Auschwitz or at Monowitz or at Buchenwald." You know, I just love him for making those straight-out statements like that. And he finishes up by saying, "Considering all this, Elie Wiesel's extreme reluctance to show his alleged serial number," meaning his tattoo, "may be taken as a confession." Well, you had said to me, you know, if you could, you want to see his arm, and when you see that there's no tattoo there, then you'll know for sure.
Yeah, we just, I myself, I'm 97% convinced. I just would like to be able to walk up to the man, take him by the forearm, and look and see if that tattoo is there. But I generally agree with everything that Mattonio says. Of course, he's a very meticulous and solid scholar. He doesn't say something unless he's thought long and hard about it. I've never ever known him to ever make a mistake in anything that he publishes. And he comes at the subject of Wiesel in the camps from a slightly different point of view from the point of view that I adopt, but we both come to basically, essentially, the same conclusions that he's a faker, he's a phony.
Well,
he's a complete phony.
Right, I think that that Mattonio is only looking at the issue of whether he was in these camps, and that's it. You know, that's pretty much what he looks at, and he's looked a little bit into the book Night and the question of the Yiddish book, who wrote it, and so on. But you, on the other hand, have got a complete, total picture of Wiesel, which nobody else has done anything as complete as you. I consider you to be the expert on Elie Wiesel. And you pronounce his name right, too, and I'm trying to get it right. I don't like to emphasize that last syllable like it's a kind of a French name or something. The proper way, as far as I understand, is Wiesel. Wiesel. I mean,
Wiesel.
Yeah, okay. Wiesel. Well, you usually say it that way, but you even, like so many others and like me, it comes out different at different times. It's hard to keep that name right.
Well, Wiesel sounds a lot better than Wiesel, definitely. Wiesel.
Well, I wanted it to sound like Wiesel because it actually, his name actually means a weasel in German. That's the meaning of the name of the word. Yeah. But I've had to change it. I've had to change my pronunciation too. I try to emphasize the first syllable, Wiesel. Wiesel. Can you talk any about those years in between 1945 and 1955, in the orphanage and so on? That's the real mysterious part. I was hoping you would get some information about him at the orphanages, more than what we've already had. I looked for everything I could find. I don't think we're ever going to know. And here's another question that people ask, Warren, whether when you say, well, he wasn't in these camps, this is a good thing to follow up with, that they say, well, where was he? If he wasn't in Auschwitz and he wasn't in Buchenwald, where was he? You can't prove a negative. You can't say he wasn't there without saying where he was.
I'm glad you asked that question. I would respond to that in this way. He was somebody, and I wouldn't be surprised. I'm going to say something radical.
Mm-hmm, good.
This is just pure speculation. We don't know what role his father actually played during the war years. His father might actually have been a German collaborator. He might have been one of the people who was policing the ghetto someplace. He might have been somebody who was an employee of the Germans during the war and managed to make it back to the West afterwards. We really don't know. But one place we could find the answer to that would be in the records held by the International Tracing Service, which were held at Bad Arolsen. These are documents that were controlled by a committee of 8 or 10 allied nations. And over the years, someone could go to the records at Bad Arolsen and with proper documentation check on a father or grandfather, grandmother. Well, 60 years after the war, approximately in 2005, they passed a law. They all voted that these records are just sitting here gathering dust, and we should open them up to researchers now. So they were digitized and sent out to the various countries that were on the committee controlling access to the documents. Those records should have, in this country, should have been sent to the National Archives, where you and I could go and consult. But instead, they were sent to the Holocaust Museum, where they have complete control over this documentation. I don't know how many millions of people are concerned, maybe 18 or 20 million, maybe 25 million people who had records of some kind, who were displaced persons, or people who have caught up in all the horrors going on everywhere across Europe for 5 years. 3/4 of those records concern people who are not Jewish. But yet, the Holocaust Museum has a monopoly on all these records. This gives you an idea as to why people like Wiesel and the rest of them, his fellow Holocaustian extremist Jewish 1% millionaire types, why they wanted to create a museum in the first place. Not as a place to as brainwashing center, of course, but also as a place to get documentation after the war, to keep the real historians from ever being able to get access to what really happened. So right now, we have no way of finding out what happened to him. There's a good chance, it's probably likely, and maybe even probable, that there's information about his whole family in the files of the International Tracing Service, but they've got those files. And,
Bad Arolsen still has them, doesn't it? Aren't they still, even though they gave them to the U.S. Holocaust Museum, they still have them at Bad Arolsen, don't they?
Oh, as far as I know, nobody has access to the files of the International Tracing Service, and the Holocaust Museum isn't letting anybody see anything.
Well, when Bad Arolsen first opened, they said, now here, this is for, you know, scholars to come and learn about. Everything is going to be open for everyone.
Have they changed that? Well, if some Jewish person who is a certified Jewish survivor, quote unquote, and wants to find out about an uncle or grandfather, I think in that case, yes, it can be done. But you can't go fishing.
Mm.
You and I, for instance, we can't go fishing, and we can't just say we want to. People who are known revisionists, they just can't go in there and go fishing and look through these files, searching for things.
Well, see, that's what I mean. That takes it out of the realm of history and into some kind of, this is all personal stuff about these people. And you don't have any right to know it.
Well, let me give you another example of how the Holocaust Museum stifles freedom of research. About 4 or 5 years ago, Dr. Mengele's diary came up for sale. Somebody who had owned it for a long time sold it. It was sold quietly and secretly in an auction someplace around Connecticut. And the identity of the person who purchased it was not revealed. I'm just going to speculate now that the entity that bought that diary was the Holocaust Museum or some wealthy person who then gave it to a place like the Holocaust Museum specifically to make it impossible for anyone to ever do justice to Dr. Mengele, who is probably the most maligned person, maybe even more maligned than Hitler or some of the top Nazis, scarring people like that. he was a totally innocent man. He was at the doctor going about doing the best he could to help people in his dispensary in Auschwitz, and he was turned into some kind of a freak, a monster that never existed. It was all made up by these self-styled eyewitnesses. His diary would have told us so much, but it's gone now, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's there in that museum. If it is, no one will ever see it.
Right. Some Jewish person bought it, didn't they? Why was it for sale?
I don't know. All I read on the web was that it was bought and that the identity of the purchaser was not released, but maybe it was released and I just...
No, I think that's right. I kind of forgot what all happened there. Well, if it wasn't, if it was a different kind of a thing, there would be an uproar. People would say, hey, we need to know these things and so on. But because it's this, no, they feel justified in keeping everything private. Yeah, that museum, well, we'll have to do another show, maybe a number of shows I would like, and for you to talk about everything you know about the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, because that museum in itself is about as bad as the whole Holocaust. I mean, it's just a representation of the same thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a disinformation entity.
Right. Well, okay,
I think it's been a great discussion. I've really enjoyed it.
Back to the program. You just listened to Julius Patzak, Austrian tenor, singing a serenade by Richard Strauss, recorded in 1941. It starts out, open up, but softly, my child. So you get the idea that it's about a young girl, a young child, it turns out to be a little girl, waking up in the morning. Very, very sweet song, and of course beautifully sung by Patzak. And, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me again for part two of this show is Warren Routledge, author of the new blockbuster book titled Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, The Memory Cult, and The Rise of Revisionism. The book is now available at Kodo Bookstore, The Barnes Review, and Amazon, of course. So, Warren, we took a little break, and we're going to finish our conversation now. Do you have any thoughts that you want to start off with, first thing?
Well, I wouldn't mind continuing where we left off the other day. Perhaps we could talk about Elie Wiesel's experiences in the camp. There is quite a bit of information in my chapter 5 that I devote to is to various anomalies in his description of his experience at Auschwitz. We could speak about that. Another thing I'd like to get into, if possible, is to talk about the truly autobiographical part of my book, where I talk about the beginning of his career in the 60s and how he encountered a great deal of skepticism from other Jews when he began his career.
Okay, I agree with that. But first, Warren, I'd like to say something that came to me as I was editing our first half, and that was that I think Wiesel's autobiography, All Rivers Run to the Sea, is more truthful about his life than Knight, even though it's not accurate either. But I think now we have to think of Knight purely as a novel, as you've called it, and turn to his autobiography as his account of his life. So, not that the autobiography does a very good job, but at least it's known to be an autobiography. Well, I also had this thought that when he says that everything in Knight is true, he's comfortable saying that because to him it means that Knight expresses the truth of the Jewish experience even if what he wrote didn't actually happen. I think that's really the way he thinks about it, why he can even perjure himself and say every word is true, because he can say, yes, this is the way it was, and that means it's true. You know how he's twisted that around, that even if things didn't happen, they're true, and things that do happen might not be true.
You're exactly right. You're absolutely correct. It's the way he remembers it, quote-unquote. And so he's telling the story. The Jewish Holocaust story is an allegory. It talks about... It talks in concrete terms, in terms of events that are described as having taken place. But the people, the Jewish people who listen to that, know that that's just a way of saying, in describing these events, it's a way of saying that they underwent a very difficult time when they were in the camps, and that the individual thing that a particular survivor says happened isn't necessarily literally true, but figuratively true. The only problem is when the media, when the controlled media gets a hold of the story, they never tell us that. They tell us that everything is literally true. And so the goyim who listen to these stories are turned off and reject them because they're obviously falsified.
Well, and Elie Wiesel knows that he knows that it's taken as true. For him to say it's true if it's true in some way because a lot of things happen to a lot of people, so that makes it true. But the rest of the world takes it as if something is true, it's historically and literally true. So he's working with that. He's letting that go by, knowing that it's full of confusion, but he wants it to be. I think that in his own mind, that's his defense. His defense is that, yes, what I'm saying is true, period, you know. So I think this needs to be exposed quite a bit. Well, I'm gonna work on that. And a couple of other things that I wanted to bring up, because we were speaking a little, we brought up Moshe the Beatle, and
yes.
And I was looking back into what he said about that, because I remembered that his father disapproved of his friendship with this Moshe. Now, see, since I think that the father in Knight was a more practical man, and he's always described his father as being a more practical, his father told him, according to the story, you are too young for that, meaning the study of the Kabbalah. And he was only 13 years old at the time. And his father said, one must be 30 before venturing into mysticism. First, you must study basic subjects. And that's exactly what Wiesel didn't want to do. He didn't want to study anything else. He didn't want to study real subjects, school subjects. He wanted to only study the Talmud, as you were talking about already. And Wiesel says in the book, I succeeded in finding a master for myself in the person of Moshe the Beatle. He spoke to me for hours on end about the Kabbalah's revelations and its mysteries. Thus began my initiation. So he was going against his father all the time. His father wasn't happy with the way he was developing and that he wasn't getting a good education. He managed to get his way, though. He was very willful, this young Ellie. And he also said that his sisters helped in the store, but as for me, my place was in the house of study, or so they said. So he's talked about this too in his autobiography, that he didn't have to work around the house. He didn't work in the store. He didn't do anything. He was just supposed to be studying, which is what Hasidic men do, and the women actually do all the work. A lot of women support the whole family because the men are good for nothing except sitting in their pile of books all day long, and this is though supposed to be something to praise them for.
Yes, that's right.
Now, I just wanted to say that you said you wanted to talk more about the camps and his experience in the camps. I just want to say that, as we already brought out, I think the most important thing for me in your book coming out, which has meant a lot to me, your great book and having that full and complete essay by Carlo Mantegna in the appendix at the end, has been very liberating for me because I am now going to spend my time in, among other things, in pointing out as much as I can that Wiesel was not in those camps. And if he was not in those camps, I mean, he is, as we mentioned in a private correspondence before, he is a complete fraud, not just a partial fraud. And, you know, see, I think this is important because, and I don't know why so many revisionists don't want to go there, want to hold back on that. Because my experience is that no matter how many lies he tells and so on and how ridiculous he is, as long as the people who believe in him, which is most people, as long as he was in those camps and he lost his mother, father, and sister, nothing else, none of this other stuff matters to them. He suffered so much. He was young, and this happened to him, and if he tells a bunch of lies, so what? But if he wasn't there, if it can be shown or if you can convince enough people that he actually wasn't there and they can't come up with the evidence that he was there, then it's all up for Elie Wiesel.
You're exactly right.
So I think that's important.
I agree completely.
And I'm so happy that you agree. See, that makes me so happy.
Well, I'm in the section where Wiesel comes into the camp and he's about to encounter Dr. Mengele, and he presents Dr. Mengele in a way that is totally different from the way the man actually looked in real life. He presents him the same way that Erich von Stroheim looked physically in the movie by Jean Renoir, La Grande Illusion, or The Grand Illusion, the bald head, German uniform, and a riding crop under his arm. Whereas in reality, Dr. Mengele didn't look like that at all. He didn't stand around with a director's baton, as Wiesel calls it, telling people to go to the left or the right. So I think that sign is absolutely staggering, and that this is supposed to be a key experience of his that he met Dr. Mengele there. Another real problem occurs in Marion Wiesel's translation of 2007. She adds some words to her English translation that are not found in the French original. Ellie walks up to Dr. Mengele and starts to describe him, and then they have the little conversation about how old he is and so forth. And then Marion Wiesel introduces the words, "We only found out later that it was Dr. Mengele." Yeah, she's trying to remedy a problem. That how would Wiesel have known who this person was when he first encountered him? But by the time he wrote the book in 1958, he could have known through his own research or contacts with these other people in the camp. He's always fond of saying, "I checked with the other survivors. I checked with the other survivors." So when he wrote the book in 1958, if he had checked with the other survivors, he would have known, oh yes, that was Mengele. But for her to stick in this sentence, we only found out later that it was Mengele, is to me, it's another admission of guilt on the part of this husband and wife tag team, Marion and Ellie, that the whole study, the whole scene, is completely made up. And here's this boy walking in with long sideburns. The sideburns are over his ears and all decked out like a Hasid. And they want us to believe, or the narrator wants us to believe, that Mengele was so stupid he thought the boy was a farmer. He was a farmhand. Oh, Jews to begin with were not farmers. They were city dwellers. So it's so incredibly insulting to the reader. I spent a little bit of time on that. And then, as you know, I developed just a little bit the image of Mengele as he is presented in the New York Times over the years. And there are so many in my files. I have so many articles from obituaries that I've cut out of the New York Times where various so-called survivors describe their experience of working for Mengele. And one description is more disgusting than the other. And in my book, I have a description of Gisela Pearl, which just goes beyond all the others. Even worse, it was published in the New York Times, and it's something that's so low down and despicable that even the lowest tabloid, like the Daily Mail, probably wouldn't even print this. But Gisela Pearl, she says of herself, she describes what it was like, or she told the reporter in the New York Times, she said, "But all of medicine was her province in the camp. As one of five doctors and four nurses chosen by Dr. Mengele to operate a hospital ward that had no beds, no bandages, no drugs, and no instruments, she tended every disease wrought by torture, starvation, filth, lice, and rats, to every broken bone or head cracked open by beating. She performed surgery without anesthesia on women whose breasts had been lacerated by whips and become infected." Now, this shows you a very, very sick person, a very sick mind. And the New York Times printed this in her obituary, that people expect people like dumb Gentiles to believe this. But this could be, of course, among Jews, they know that this isn't true. They know it's not true. It's just a hyperbolic way of saying she had a tough time while she was in the camp. They know it's not literal. But it's the CIA, the people who control the media, who put this forth as having been literally true.
I don't know why they do that. I can't understand.
Part of it's an in-joke among them that they're able to get the goyim, who are so stupid, that they believe all this. And so it's like a game. They want to say things that are more and more outrageous and in violation of the laws of nature, and then see it in print, and they have a chuckle among themselves. But boy, this is printed in the paper, and the dumb goy are going to be walking around feeling guilty about this.
Some people think that it has a pornographic strain in Jews who like to talk like this and like to think about things like this, and if they had their opportunity, I guess they would treat people like this if they thought they were their enemies. And that's why they come up with these outrageous kind of
torture. It's just ridiculous.
So I was going to ask you, Warren, when you mentioned Wiesel coming to Auschwitz in the book Night, he would have had those ringlets, whatever.
He would have had the sideburns. He would
have been dressed. Orthodox Jew. But, you know, there's that picture of him with that suit on, with just his buttoned shirt, no tie, where he's supposed to be 15 years old. And it's always said that this was taken before they were deported to Auschwitz. And that's always taken that way, that this was him in his hometown, you know, living the good life. But he's got very close cropped hair. Dark hair. He doesn't have any of that Hasidic look. So what do you say about that?
Well, I'm not sure what your
question
is.
You know that picture? You have compared it to the picture of him, the person in the Buchenwald camp that's supposed to be Wiesel in that famous photograph of the liberation of Buchenwald. You've compared those two pictures, and you also compared that picture to him in a younger picture that was only a couple years earlier than that, where he looks very young. But in neither of these pictures does he have these.
That's true. That's a very interesting point. He doesn't have them in either picture. That's a really troubling question. And also, not only the two pictures in my book, but some of the pictures that appear on your website, some of the pictures that were taken at the refugee center outside Paris, he doesn't seem to have any of those curls over his ears in those pictures either. So he considered himself Orthodox, but he didn't seem to consider himself ultra-Orthodox enough to have that kind of a haircut.
Well, now, this really does open up something new, more than I had even been thinking about. Another area to consider, you know, according to the pictures of him, how Orthodox were they in that family? And yet he spent all his time at the synagogue, as you say, you know, praying and meeting with people that he could study mysticism with.
Well, that brings up a very interesting question, because we were discussing in the first part of this show my reference to the description of the young Orthodox boys engaging in erotic behavior, boys and possibly girls engaging in erotic behavior. And I said in the cattle car, while all the other people looked aside, and I said to you, that reads to me like something that would be written by a Jewish guy who's not Orthodox. He's a cultural Jew who doesn't terribly like Orthodox Jews, and that's the case of many, many, if not most, non-religious Jews. And it's, maybe, in fact, Wiesel actually wrote this passage. Who knows? But this is another contradictory aspect to it, that maybe, in fact, he didn't grow up. He didn't grow up in a tightly Orthodox setting, and which would only prove that the so-called autobiography is really, in fact, a novel, which I've said it is all along, in which he made up a character who is an Orthodox Jewish boy who is totally different from himself.
Yeah, right. And that goes back to his past. What was he really doing? If he wasn't in those camps, there has to be some kind of search for where he would have been. Now, you mentioned that maybe his father, just speculating, you know, that maybe his father was a collaborator with the Germans. My thought goes in the other direction, that he was possibly a resistance fighter amongst the Jews. In fact, there's a relative, and there's two of those forms that people fill out for Yad Vashem that say that his father died, and his uncle too, his father and his father's brother, both died in 1943. And if something like that were to be turn out to be the case, you can't really trust those forms, but then maybe the family somehow managed to leave the area or go west, and they had relatives in the Netherlands that come up at a later time, and I went into that some. But as you say, you know, you don't know where to go to find out any real information. But that leads to possibilities that he was near France and ended up there at that orphanage without having come from Buchenwald. And I had the idea that he was at that, with that OSE, that French Jewish orphanage group that looked after these kids and other kids too, not just kids from Buchenwald. And he was kind of he wasn't actually one of the wards at that time. He was kind of a teacher or maybe a group leader, you know, one of the staff who was there helping out the kids, because he looks a little older than the others. Well, there's a lot of possibilities, but no proof, unfortunately, so far.
One thing we know is that if he wound up in that group home, the Orthodox group home for teenage boys who were displaced persons, there must have been, at least on the ground by the people who put him on that train, there must have been evidence that if his parents weren't deceased, at least he was separated from his parents, He could have been separated from his parents, but didn't know, but they were still alive. We don't know. But when he got there, it wasn't too long after he got there he was able to reconnect with his sister. I don't go into this in the book, but he claims that his picture appeared in the paper one day in Paris, or some kind of a little newspaper that was published among all the Jewish refugees. And his sister saw his picture in the paper. She had also miraculously wound up in the Paris area, and she found out. So the father might have worked for the Germans. We can't rule out anything here.
No, you can't rule out. I'm just saying that there's other possibilities. Now, the thing with that picture in the paper, I finally got hold of that picture. And I was so thrilled about that, and I've got it on the site, Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World. And it's a picture of a boy playing chess, and his sister, when she gave that interview to the Shoah Foundation, she revealed a lot of things that are very interesting, and I've written all about that, whatever was useful in it. But she says, I think that she's going along with his story, but this photograph that was in the newspaper is not Elie Wiesel. It's not him as a young boy that age. It's somebody else. Doesn't look anything like him. Even the body shape and everything is different. And you can look on my site. I'll make a note to give you the link to it and look at it yourself. So this is another fake story. Now this brings up, and this is the last thing I wanted to say before you start in on some of the things you want to talk about, and that is that another clue that I was just noticed yesterday, I was going back over some articles, and in what I wrote on January 2nd, 2011, in the first article of Elie Wiesel and the Mossad, which was a four-part series, but in the first one, he writes that he wrote in his autobiography, All Rivers, his memoir, that he and his young fellow survivors wanted to go to Palestine right from Buchenwald, but naturally their American liberators wouldn't allow them to do that. They settled for free transportation and lodgings in France, sponsored by the Jewish Welfare Agency, a Jewish Welfare Agency, and also the OSCE, and also the government of Charles de Gaulle. And I said, if it turns out to be true that Wiesel was not at Buchenwald, as I believe, now I wrote, saying I want people to know I said that in January 2011, then he was not on that particular passenger trip to France either, that he describes on page 109 of his memoir. There he gives a strange explanation for why he never received French nationality. And you know how he went on and on about being a stateless person. Well, he wrote this, but he said the train stopped at the border. They got off, and a police official made a speech. Now, it must have been the French border, and the speech was in French, but he didn't understand anything about it, and he saw people raising their hands, and he assumed they were volunteering for some task, but he later found out that the policeman had asked for a show of hands of all those who wished to become French citizens. Since I did not respond, he said, they probably wrote in my file, refused French nationality. Probably, he says. The consequence of my blunder was endless harassment and administrative hassles. Now, this is questionable, I say, but it's really stupid explanation for why we remained stateless for so long. But now, why would the boys be expected to know French? Of course they wouldn't. So they wouldn't have a man speaking to them in French and not interpreted for them on such an important issue, as this is when they were going to say whether they wanted to become French nationals. And how would they know before they ever got there anyway whether they wanted to do that? So, secondly, there were two Jewish American Army chaplains accompanying them on this trip to help them out and assist them, American Jews, Army chaplains, who were looking out for their welfare. But they obviously weren't looking out for Wiesel there if he was not allowed to make a choice on that because he didn't understand it. And third, Wiesel says, they probably wrote in my file. Didn't he ask about it? He's saying later, they probably did this. He never showed any interest to find out. And yet he's saying he suffered so much from being a stateless person. And, of course, that would have all been straightened out if he had just spoken up and said, oh, what, this happened, you know, and I came from Buchenwald. And of course, they'd be happy to make him a French national if he was one of the boys from Buchenwald, which says to me, this simple little part in his autobiography, that he made up this story to cover why he remained stateless when maybe others did not and became French nationals at that time. So he's again making a silly story up, which doesn't fit the world as we know it, and yet nobody questions him about it. There's more evidence that he didn't come from Buchenwald.
Well, I that could very well be. I'm not aware of all these new pieces of information, and they're entirely plausible, and that could very well be. He could have come on a train of refugees, but from a different place.
Sure, a lot of things could have happened, and I think it was different than what he says. I was going to ask you, actually, but I might put you on the spot. What I think is kind of clear why, but maybe people don't understand it. Why is it that so many revisionists don't want to refuse to think that Elie Wiesel was not the same guys as Lazar Wiesel and the other Lazar Wiesel and so on that are on all these documents, and that his father his name was changed to Abram for some reason, and that really meant him. Why do so many revisionists not want to take the position that you and Carlo Mantegna and I have taken?
Well, maybe it's because they're afraid that Wiesel might produce a picture at some point through some means, claiming that this is a picture of his arm with his tattoo on it. And, of course, nobody will be able to refute that because Wiesel has an opportunity at some point through subterfuge to claim that he has a tattoo. They might be afraid of that. I don't know, but I agree with you and Mantegna that to me he definitely was not. He was not at Buchenwald, definitely.
Well, and you know why? How could he produce a tattoo now after all this time? We see we have pictures of his arm without it. There's no way. I mean, I know that this is what a lot of people say. That's an excess of caution to my mind, you know, and they've made that argument to me over the website, which is, you know, about where's the tattoo, you know, oh, you got to be careful with this. No, it's ridiculous. Why hasn't he done it? He would have done it by now. He's going to be dead pretty soon.
Yeah,
This is ridiculous. I think they might think that there's an outside possibility that he was there and the records are messed up, but again, I think that's an excess of caution because they haven't come up with anything. And you know how Ken Walzer tried to make out a case for that with proof and so on, and he failed miserably.
Yeah, it's true.
So I think that there are some revisionists, Warren, who I like the idea of talking about Elie Wiesel at Auschwitz and all the tall tales that he told and all the ridiculous stories and how wrong he was and make him out to be a liar. And they're so happy with that that they don't want to go beyond that. And if he wasn't there, then his stories are not real. For example, the favorite story is the one about the operation on his foot in night, and he could have stayed behind, but he decided to go with the Germans and how that proves this, that, and the other thing. They like that story so much, and if we have to look at it that he wasn't there, then all these stories, none of these things happened, you know, none of this stuff happened. And so it changes the whole picture, and I don't think they're prepared to do that. These are people who are good revisionists in a lot of areas, but they have not studied Elie Wiesel the way you have, for sure, and not the way I have. And even Carlo Mantegna took the trouble to go and look into all of this deeply. And these other people haven't done that.
Well, people have different opinions about that. I think that just because a Wiesel, for instance, claims that he had an operation in January over at the Monowitz SS camp doesn't mean that actually happened. I mean, it's so far-fetched. And it doesn't prove that he was there. I'm not sure, but I think Levy, the Italian novelist who wrote This Is a Man, I think he might have had an operation as well when he was in the same hospital. I wondered if he might, if Wiesel might have plagiarized that book, which was published in time early enough for him to have read it and to have taken some ideas from it. But I'm not sure. I've never expressed an opinion one way or another. But the whole notion that he has this operation, a very serious operation, and he requires 2 weeks of bed rest, and then 3 days later, he takes this long 60-kilometer walk. It's just so far-fetched, I can't believe it. I really do not believe that he was actually there. It's my personal opinion.
Yeah, and here's another thing that was brought to my mind yesterday, that he started writing for the newspaper Zion in Kampf, which is an Irgun newspaper, Irgun, the terrorist group, in November 1947. So just think that about two years after he is gets out of that Buchenwald camp and he's in Paris, that he goes from being a 17-year-old lost soul, you know, just out of this slave camp and all the trauma he's been through and so on. And 2 years later, he's a journalist for this resistance newspaper and knows all these people in the resistance movement. That doesn't make much sense, does it?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Well taken. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we could probably, knowing that this is an important issue, it's important for me, that I could probably come up with more things to point out about it. And you've certainly covered lots and lots of things in your book that show that his being in the camps doesn't make any sense. I hope that you will come back, Warren, and talk with me again soon. Would you do that?
Well, I don't think it will happen soon. I think I still have a couple other people I have to have interviews with, and I don't want to come back and have a second interview with one person while I'm still waiting to have my first interview with somebody else. So
sure,
it'll happen.
Sure. Well, no, I wasn't talking about like next week or anything that soon, but I would like to hear the whole story from you about Wiesel in the Catholic Church, because that plays a very large part in your book, and you touched on it, but there's so much more to say. It's very interesting how he became a kind of a spearhead for the Jewish influence over the Catholic Church.
Well, that's a good idea. That's a good idea, but it won't be for a while. It's summertime. There's a lot going on in my life, and it'll happen, but it's not. It depends upon what your definition of soon is. It's not going to happen in the next week or two.
Oh, no.
We'll just be in touch. But I appreciate your inviting me on the show very much, and also look forward to cooperating with you and working together with you. And I appreciate all the work you do on your website. It's phenomenal, all the things you've discovered.
Well, thanks. I'll look forward to talking to you again about this. And thanks for being on the program, Warren.
Thank you. I look forward to coming back and talking about Pope Pius XII and Elie Wiesel. That'll be interesting. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And so, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager on May 11th, 2015. My guest has been Warren B. Routledge, author of Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, The Memory Cult, and The Rise of Revisionism. Hope to see you again next week. Good night.